Hello,
Hello, everyone.
However you identify, you are welcome on our journey of broadcasting excellence.
Where we chat a lot of bollocks for a couple of lads that don't have any.
Too true. Although it does take balls to tell a lot of the stories on here to the public.
It sure does, mate. Each week we discuss a topic tenuously linked to being trans, from coming out to dildos and dildon'ts to special guests.
I am Satch.
And I'm Leo, and this is our transmission.
Our series sponsors are The Agora, where life begins.
The Agora is a fertility treatment centre that helps all kinds of parents-to-be. It has the highest success rates in London and the South East.
They are partnering with brands like ours to develop their specialism of trans fertility treatment.
With over 2,000 babies born through this fabulous fertility facility.
Fabulous fertility facility.
It has an excellent team and exceptional care for both you and your baby-to-be.
So, without further ado, let's find out what we are on about this week.
Hello!
Hello!
Satch and Leo's transmission. That's our theme tune, Kate. What do you think of that?
I love it. Yeah. It's great. Yeah. And you know what? I love your Agora thing as well.
Yeah, oh, thank you.
We're sponsored by the Agora. We love a bit of the Agora.
Where life begins.
Yeah, your little jingle, it's great. They should pay you extra for that.
They absolutely, yeah, you're totally right. And as a professional songwriter, it's my proudest achievement, I think, is that theme jingle. today we have Kate Nambier on. Welcome, Kate. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I'm so happy to be here.
And yay!
Really happy.
Aww. Well, she's saying that now, but she hasn't been through the questions yet, so which Leo has slaved over. So let's see what we come up with. Shall I read this intro you've written then, mate?
Yeah, you go ahead. I think I'd trip over it. I've said a lot of words.
Okay, right. So this week we have a guest that is infinitely more qualified than us. That is true. Dr. Kate Nambier has got all the BAs, MBs, BSs and PhDs. I'm just saying the alphabet to help us talk about all things LGBT, specifically trans health. Dr. Kate is an advocate. Are we supposed to say Dr. Nambier, not Dr. Kate?
No, call me Dr. Kate. It's
Dr. Kate.
Dr. Kate.
Or just call me Kate. I don't mind.
Is an advocate for equality for trans patients and specializes in gender identity, sexual health, and HIV medicine. Stop me if any of this is wrong, Kate, and we'll fire our research team immediately. Basically, whilst me and Leo were necking pints in a Toby Carvery car park, Dr. Nambier was necking books on medicine at university. She's the three S's, smart, successful, and so ready to be on our podcast. Here we go. How was that, Kate?
That's awesome. That's the best intro I've ever had.
Definitely.
Okay. Yeah.
The research team is rehired. They can keep their jobs this week. Okay, so we're gonna read these questions then, and you are going to answer them, and it's gonna be a fun time shall be had by all. Okay, Leo, do you want to do odds or evens?
Oh, I always go odd. I just feel like that because I'm an odd person. I need to do odd.
Okay. You're on the right podcast then, mate. Yeah, You're gonna go odds.
I'm gonna go odd.
Okay.
I feel like I want a thing that goes.
You want we need to get like like more theme tunes in and kind of sound effects and stuff. Yeah. That'll be season three when we've made our millions.
Yeah, and then you get £1 million at the end of the 10 questions if you make it through. Not just yet, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, right, go on then, mate. Odd number one.
Question number one. What is a typical day in the life of Kate Nambier? Dr. Kate.
Oh, that's a good question. I have to say, you guys haven't primed me with these questions in advance. So this is completely off the...
They always are, Kate.
This is good. So a typical day. Well, things have changed quite a bit with lockdown. Mm-hmm. Right. So at the moment, I do two jobs. So I work at the Gender Identity Clinic in London, and that's where I've been today. Awesome. And I also work in Brighton, where I do sexual health, so sexual reproductive health. And I run a clinic there called Clinic T, which is our trans healthcare.
Yeah.
So on the days I'm coming into the on the days I'm doing like stuff at the GIC, we have a mixture of doing appointments on Zoom or face-to-face appointments at clinic, which is what I've been doing today. So I get up in the morning, you don't need to know all the bits of what I do.
No, we do. This
Why do you need to know this?
What we want to know.
Do you want to know? I get up in the morning, sort of stagger to brush my teeth, have some breakfast, and then get myself ready to get out. And if I'm coming up to the clinic, I'll take the... I live on a boat in Canary Wharf.
And wow. That's so cool. So,
yeah, it's really cool. So, but it's on the same tube line that comes up to the clinic, which is based, so the GIC's now moved and we're up in North London at Finchley Road.
Round the corner from my house. We just discussed this. Amazing.
Yeah, we're talking about this. So I'll come into work. We usually have in the morning, we either have some meetings, which we do on Zoom, or we'll just get straight into all the admin. So basically I get sent a lot of letters, blood test results and things from GPs and other specialists, and it's my job to have a look through all of those. Yeah. Make decisions about, you know, people on the right hormone therapy, you know, do we need to change the dose. So my job here at the GIC is endocrinology, which is basically hormone therapy. So when I'm seeing people or doing the admin stuff, a lot of it is deciding about what's the right treatment for the people that we're seeing, and we spend a long time trying to discuss what's going to work for you, you're on the right dose, you're having side effects, you're having problems, the effects that you want to see, are they happening fast enough, or are the effects that you're seeing that you actually don't want, are they not so good for you? So we try and work all that sort of stuff out.
Cool.
So that's my usual day over here. When I am doing sexual health, I have to get on the train and go all the way down to Brighton, which is lovely. It's where I used to live. And I love it down there. I really miss it. But my colleagues are still there. I worked in the clinic in Brighton for years and years and years. But that's a general sexual health clinic. And because of lockdown, we do so much of our stuff as phone calls. So we'll talk to people on the phone and try to solve anything that we can over the phone. And if we need to see people, we'll get them in and see them in the clinic later on that day. And it's all to do with looking after people's sexual health, so screening them for sexually transmitted infections, looking at any symptoms they might have, if they've got any issues, genital health issues, talking about contraception, all sorts of stuff like
all
that.
Of the things.
All of those kind of things. Yeah. So that is my... that's kind of what I do in a like general work day.
Okay, and what do you do at a weekend when it's not lockdown?
when it's not lockdown, it depends. I can meet up with friends. I love paddleboarding, so the fact that I live on a boat next to the water, I just like pump up my board and actually go paddle somewhere, go out. I've kind of got back into running as well. So I think it's a lockdown thing. I just thought, one, I need to get fit, and two, it's kind of I used to do it a lot. My best friend is she is like amazing runner. She like does like half marathon after half marathon, all the sort of thing. So I thought, you know what, I've got to do something like that. So
God, I need to. My dad's a marathon runner, but it doesn't have any effect on me. But maybe I need to take a leaf out of Dr. Kate's book on the running front. Cool. Okay. Question two. What do you think is the most important health issue for trans people today? That's a big question.
I don't think I can give you like one thing because it's so
many issues that we have.
I think probably the thing that affects people the most is actually our mental health. And I'm talking as a trans person as well. So, I think that, I'm not a mental health specialist, but the number of people who are affected by mental health issues it's not being trans as a mental health problem. It's all the other stuff that goes with it, people's anxiety issues, depression, suicidality, all of these kind of things. It's hard to find somebody who is trans who isn't affected in some way by that. A lot of it, I think, is just the way that we are, the society views us, and the individual circumstances that the people have going through transition, that how that the huge upheaval it has in your life.
It's
almost unusual. I don't know if you guys think this, but it'd be almost unusual if you didn't have some kind of some sort of effect on your mental health.
We've said this on here before. I think you'd be really hard pushed to find a trans person that hasn't had their mental health affected. And I don't think it's, like you said, it's not from being trans. It's from transphobia, from not being able to access treatment, from all these, like you said, all these other things that go with it, rather than actually being trans. Trans itself.
Yeah, I had that when I was a medical student. I transitioned then, and that was the, on one hand, there were some great things about transitioning. I could actually live like the life that I wanted to live, and I could be properly, authentically, really me. But it's just hard being, being in that kind of pressured environment.
Yeah,
having to, all this stuff you have to conform to. I think particularly in medicine, it's kind of a very conservative profession in some respects. And that was a time when my mental health really kind of nosedived. The only time I've ever felt suicidal was then. I'm very fortunate that's only happened to me, that one time. The only time I've ever felt like I've been really, really depressed was then. And I'm glad to have come out the other side of that.
Similar to you, I feel like I came out while I was at university, but I had to quit and go back home. So it's so good and like resilient that you carried on through, especially in such a hard profession like medicine.
Well, I'll tell you what, the thing that made the difference is actually having someone there to, a really good ally to help me through. And I was at St Mary's at the time in London, and the med school is back then. This was like the mid-90s when I was there, and the med school at that time didn't have like this sort of personal tutor scheme but they felt that it would probably be a good thing for me, because I said when I came joined the med school that I was transitioning, and and they kind of felt, this person might need some extra help. So they assigned someone, and she was so lovely. When I was feeling really down, I could just knock on her door and have a chat. She'd make a cup of tea. We'd just have a talk through things. When I was really low, when I was, that time when I was feeling like, I just wanted to end it all. I remember thinking, because, St Mary's is right next to Paddington Station, and there's like a bridge that goes over the line. I remember looking at it, I think, if I just chucked myself off this, that would be it.
Oh, so don't know, Kate, no!
I can talk about it now, but at that time, it was really dark. It was difficult. I remember going to see her. She was a consultant. She actually worked in sexual health. It was one of the reasons I went into that specialty. I remember seeing her, and then she was really worried, and actually she got me some help that I really needed. So she got me to see a clinical psychologist, and that was, and I know I was really lucky. I was really privileged. And I know lots of people who really need help, quickly and urgently. Have to wait and have to struggle through and have to do that, and I'm incredibly grateful to her for for stepping in and getting me the help that I really needed to.
Thank you for being so candid about that, because it's really important that we talk about this stuff, because then people can relate and we can eradicate the shame. But that's the same for us, really. Like we met at university. We both came out at uni. And I almost deferred but didn't. Leo deferred and then came back and completed the degree, which I think in some ways that's even more of an achievement to come back and face that. But I think having we were kind of each other's mentors, I guess.
Yeah, we always say like we needed each other to get through it.
Yeah,
which is why we started this podcast. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the thing. You're having someone with you, someone to to walk with you, someone to to talk to when things are looking bleak, and just to like cheer you up and to get you through.
Yeah,
it's so important.
So for people that this is like a little side question, which always happens, but for people that are waiting, and we've already promised we're not going to sit here and talk about the long waits or anything like that. But for the people that are stuck waiting for treatment and stuff like that, would that be your advice to them then to try and, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to try and find somebody to talk to about it, or do you have what would be your top tip for people in that situation?
It's really difficult. I think there's nobody that I know that works in gender services that isn't really upset and distressed and frustrated with the fact that there's these colossal waiting lists. And I think for each person it is really difficult, and but it's different in terms of how people manage. So some people manage by just getting together within the community, and there's all this sort of support that you have. Like in Brighton, I used to be a trustee of a charity called Clare Project, and you might have heard of them. An amazing charity, but for years and years have been doing peer support for the trans community. So there's other trans people helping out other people, and just to know that you're not alone, and that there is light at the end of the tunnel. That tunnel might be a lot really long, but there is light at the end of the tunnel. It's just a lifeline, people get through that time in all sorts of different ways. But I honestly wish that we could do more to sort that out.
If I'm jumping ahead on questions here, Leo, then just you'll have to just beat me later, but which he does. What needs to be done to fix that? This is the thing. I'm sure that's totally right, that the staff struggle with it, almost as much as the people waiting. But I guess it's just that it's underfunded, it's under resourced. Yeah. There's not enough. So what's the answer? What needs to happen? Is it a political thing? What do we need to do?
There's quite a few things. So yeah, basically the NHS at the moment isn't commissioning enough services, so they're basically not generating enough clinics and enough people working within the field to cope with the demand. So that's the one thing is about that. So they have committed to do something. So there's some new clinics that are opening. There's some more in the pipeline. So there is some stuff that's happening. But really, there's thousands of people on the waiting list, and so we're going to need a pretty big radical overhaul. I kind of think that if you think about it, all the studies that have looked at there, I reckon there's probably, somewhere between 0.1% to 1% of the population have some kind of, gender diversity. And not everybody's going to want to have medical treatment, but that's still a lot of people.
Have you had any other
medical condition with that kind of prevalence, so that kind of number of people, you wouldn't just rely on having a tiny number of clinics just scattered around the country. You'd have a more you'd have a different system to manage it. So I think one of the things that we are looking at is to see how much of the care that we do, the initial care to get people onto assessed and to get people onto the treatment they need, can be decentralized. So it doesn't have people don't have to wait to see a specialist within a
so they could get help from their GP stuff, and then that's a good idea.
I think so. I mean, I think that at the moment what we're working with is having to have these specialist clinics, and we try our best to do a really good job within the specialist clinic as best we can, but ultimately you'd have to open so many clinics and have so many people trained, and it takes a while to train somebody. When you've already got a network of people working in primary care, why not utilize that? Ultimately that's the kind of vision that I have, but it is somewhat different to the way things are are set up at the moment, and I think that it's going to take some time before we can kind of move towards that. At the moment, if you talk to GPs are already pressured in terms of the work that they have to do,
With corona as well.
Exactly. I think all of us working in the health service with COVID have had to really adapt to the way we're working, so I think that unfortunately these long waits are going to be with us for quite a while yet. But
yeah, well, thank you for the frontline work you do.
Yeah.
What would you say, this is another question that has just come into my mind, it's off script, but what would you say to people, and I'm sure we've all, I would be very shocked if all three of us hadn't come across this at some point, to people that say stuff like we don't deserve the care and the services. There's people with cancer. There's people that, you know, the NHS is under too much pressure. So there shouldn't be as many trans services as there are.
Okay. Without after
you can swear on this show, Kate. Don't you worry.
No, I'm not. I won't do that. Don't worry. That's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, you know, just because, you know, we have a health service that doesn't, we don't need to say, you know, you deserve treatment, but you don't deserve treatment. That's not, you know, there's nothing that in any of my training or in any of the training that any of us do as healthcare professionals that say that you know, people who aren't deserving of healthcare shouldn't receive it. That is a crazy way of thinking. You know, the improvement that you get in people's ability to live, to be able to function, is actually it's so significant from an intervention that you can do that compared to some other medical treatment where, you know, people are on having lifelong treatment and really struggling with things. Actually, you can make a massive difference in the functioning of somebody's life by getting people through the process of transition. And I think it doesn't it makes no sense to say, you know, you don't deserve treatment and then risk people's mental health deteriorating and then having to try to manage that, when actually what you could have done is actually, you know, deal with the gender issues. I've never thought that, you know, we should be in the business as medics or as healthcare professionals of saying this person it's okay to have treatment, but this person shouldn't because they've got, you know, a condition. You know, we should go into them thinking everybody is in need of healthcare, should be able to get it. That should be a basic fundamental right.
You're speaking our language, Kate. Right, okay, Leo. Question 3. Actually, it's probably really about question 15, and that's all my fault. Go on, Leo. Question three.
Right. So, how did you get into medicine, or what was the thing that sort of spurred the love for wanting to I don't know, fix people's.
Fix people's shit. That's a job title. That's fix some people's shit.
Professional fixer.
It's a professional description.
Shit.
Yeah. So it's kind of one of those things that I've always wanted to do from when I was little. It was one of those things. I don't know if you ever did this, but I found a little thing that I'd written from when I was like, it must have been like 5. It's like written in like kids' handwriting about what you're going to do when you grow up. And I put it into an envelope and sealed it and said, do not open until I can't remember, it was like age 20 or something like that. It was like ages ago.
Wow,
I
found a time capsule.
A time capsule. It's like a little time capsule that I'd written. And in there it said, when I grow up, I want to be a doctor. So I said, okay, written in the stars. Yeah. It's one of those weird things. I found it looking through. My mum never throws anything away.
So she dug it up
with all my other stuff from when I was a kid that has the same. Mum, why have you kept this? What are you? Yeah. So, but that one, I was really glad that she had. But I think it was in the family as well. So my mum was a nurse and dad worked as a biomedical scientist. So he worked in the labs.
Wow.
So there was a kind of medical thingy going on. So they were like super proud when I got into medical school. But it was never kind of like a, you must do this. It wasn't like a pressure on me. Like, for example, my brother's an artist. So he went completely different direction.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, I'm always very grateful, actually. My parents were really, they were super encouraging of me, but they were also really kind of open and free in terms of the stuff that they let us do, and particularly around my transition as well. They were incredibly supportive.
Oh wow,
that's awesome.
Great. Yeah. It's good. Nice to hear.
Yeah.
That there are. It's such a commendable profession as well. Like, it's so good to want to do something that's just like so hard, so long to do. It's like so many years.
Yeah, how many years did you have to train?
Just 6 years. 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've done 5 years, but that's in summary. I can't help you, but I can write a song about it.
You can do it. I can't write a song, so I mean, you know that.
Leo, what did you want to be when you were younger?
You know what? I was thinking about this earlier. I wanted to be a pilot for a while.
Nice. Yeah. I wanted to be a paramedic.
That's pretty odd. So
could have been helpful, but not. Oh well, it's all right. Dr. Kate's got it all covered, sorted. Okay, question 4. Did you always know you wanted to focus on sexual health and gender identity in your work?
No, actually, that's so sexual health. When I was a student, just partly being, you know, really helped by that.
Oh, that person. You said,
yeah, she was really inspiring. So her name was Dr. Libby Clayton, and she's a consultant that works down in Devon. And you know what? I've never, I just thinking about her, and I've never properly thanked her for the help that she
maybe she'll
gave
listen
me.
To this, Kate.
She left London and moved to Devon in my last year as a medical student, and I remember trying to go back and see her, and she'd already left, and I thought, oh, you know, I was feeling so much better. So but anyway, she was really inspiring, and I loved the job, and the people in it were kind of like, you know you find your tribe, do you know what I mean?
You find people that you kind of
really click with and get on with, and it's also a super accepting bit of the profession in terms of LGBTQ plus identity. There's many people there who are gay or lesbian, bi, and you know that kind of I can fit in here really well. But in terms of gender stuff, no. And you know, it might I don't know. See, back then, one of the things that you know was sort of your measure of success as a trans person was basically how, you know, I kind of see it as being how cis could you be, so how much could you integrate it? It was literally like that. I try my best anyway not to have that in, you know, in the work I do now, and I know lots of my colleagues don't do that, but it was basically to try to forget about being trans. And I think that left me with this like this sense of internalized transphobia, I think. Mm. You know, this massive sense of shame about being trans. So for years and years, I tried my best to like not even think about it, to not even talk about it, to just basically like, you know, that's in the past. I don't want to deal with it, and just do other stuff. And it was only much later on that I kind of realized that I was potentially in a position that I could do a lot. I could help people. You know, I could make a really tangible difference in people's lives. And it was, I don't think you might be telling you this, but it was a friend of mine who was transitioning in the same place. He was a doctor as well. He worked in the same hospital, and I remember he had posted this message around to all of the staff, telling people that he was going to go to transition, and you know, this is his name and how we should. You know, just to let people know, basically. And I remember thinking at that time, it's like, oh, you know, maybe I should reach out to him and, you know, and say, you know, it's probably a time where you could, you know, do with a friend and do with somebody who'd, you know, been through something similar, and just to be able to have somebody to relate to. But I thought about it, and I didn't do anything at the time. And it was only after that, when I met him again later down the line, that I realized how hard a time he had had, and how difficult it had been for him going through transition, and I kind of realized, being this way and not being open and not being able to, and feeling so ashamed of being trans, it's hurting me and it's hurting other people, and it's you know, I'm in a position where I've been incredibly privileged to have had all that support around me when I was transitioning. If I don't if I can't even give a little bit of that back to the people that I can potentially make a difference to, then what am I doing? Why did I get into medicine in the first place? You know,
it's
that's it was around that time, that was like 2012, and that's when we started Clinic T. I'm really proud of that, and I'm glad that that's still, you know,
yeah,
still
you
going
be.
Strong, and we're still helping, you know, in Brighton, particularly Brighton.
A cousin of mine went to Clinic T last year. I've got about 1,000 cousins, so I can say that. Okay. It's for no one to know who it is, but that's you must have helped loads of people with that. And we've talked about this before, like, it's by no means in the same way, but we're doing this podcast, and in our writing, Leo's a writer as well. When we write about,
write.
Shut up, you're a writer. He gets his crayons out occasionally. But we write about this stuff, and he's actually co-writing with me on a trans album at the moment. We were talking about it the other day, and we were saying that pursuit to help other people makes purpose of the pain that we've been through. So yeah, just as you were talking then, it's just it helps eradicate the shame.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. That's a great quote.
You can have that one, Kate. You can write that down. You can have that.
I will do.
Occasionally, we say something valuable. Occasionally.
I can see it's the skill of the songwriter. You just like,
Okay. Question five, Leo.
Question five. Okay. So I don't know. This one is, how do you find working for the Gender Identity Clinic? Open-ended one.
It's great, actually. I work with some amazing people here, and some great colleagues. I've met some incredible allies here, people who will go the extra mile to help people out. I'll be honest with you, it was a little difficult to start off with. And I think when I started, and I told my friends, my trans friends, I was coming to work here, people were like, oh my God, really? It was a bit like, you know, it's like, you're turning to the dark side, that kind of thing. You know? I don't think they'll mind me telling you that. And there are times, I'll be honest with you, there are times when, you know, I have that kind of facepalm moment. I think, oh God, did you really say that? Oh no. Or I think, you know, actually that's not on, you know, we have to try to, you know, that's not good. You know, we have to try to change that. And I think part of the reason I went to it was to, one is, like, you know, I was telling you before, to try to really make a difference to help people, but also to try to shift the position of the GIC. And there's lots of people I know who work here that do feel that we're stuck in a model of the past, and it's, you know, and trying to move this ship is actually going to be really difficult. It needs a lot of people to try to push the
and needs trans needs trans people working
yeah, needs,
there,
needs people to kind of
yeah and
do it from within, you know, like
yeah, definitely. And I think it's going to be slow, and it's going to be, you know, it's the stuff isn't going to happen overnight. But I do. There's other trans people on the, you know, within the team, and as you know, as well. But you know, also there's lots of cis people here who are, you know, really, you know, really, really good, and really, really, really happy and proud to work with them. So yeah, it's like working anywhere. You know, nothing's perfect. You know, I recognize there's a lot. There's a lot to be done. There's a lot of change to be made. And you know, there's sometimes I struggle sometimes with the you know, the you know, with some of the decisions that are made. I just think, oh, I wish we didn't have to do that. But
you're there fighting the good fight.
Yeah,
I try my best. I try to do what I can, and I kind of acknowledge that it's not a perfect system.
It's like most things are, like, in trans rights, trans healthcare. Is that we've come a long way, but there's still a way to go. And I guess that's the same with that. I got a letter from the gender clinic the other day, which was a write up of an appointment, and it was just like, Joshua lives at home with that's my real name. Joshua lives at home with his girlfriend and his dog and his tropical fish. It's just like, just reading it, it's just like, why do we have to have it like this? Or it's like,
It's like a narrative. I had one narrative of your life.
And you feel like a guinea pig, and you're being studied in some way. Yeah. And it's just like, yeah. Anyway, let's not go down this. Let's not open this can of worms. We'll be here all day. Okay, question six. You tweeted recently about it being, see Leo does do quality research.
Do some research, yeah. Oh, God, just checking my tweets.
Okay. Professional stalker.
I knew we'd monetize your skills as an online stalker one day, mate. You tweeted recently about it being really concerning that many trans men who are eligible for PrEP are not given information, are not prescribed it, and fewer are taking it. What is PrEP and what are things that we can do so that trans people have the access to the information and resources they need?
Okay, that's a cool question. So PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. And so basically, it's treatment that you can take to protect yourself from getting HIV.
Wow.
It's a tablet that you take once a day. And it has very, very few side effects. It's been tested really extensively, and it is incredibly effective. So for people who are having sex where they potentially could get HIV, having PrEP can stop that from happening. And a lot of people don't know about it. And I think particularly trans people, just aren't aware of it. But it's been around for a long time. I think for us working in sexual health, we talk a lot about PrEP, and it's been a lot of the organizations that work particularly with gay men have been talking about PrEP for some time. And it's predominantly cis gay men who are have been the driving force behind getting PrEP kind of more talked about and more known within their community. But it's actually helpful to a much wider range of people, and that's really, I think, kind of the new frontier. And that's part of the reason that I tweeted that there are many not just trans guys but trans women as well, people non-binary who could potentially benefit from PrEP.
That's awesome.
The only reason I knew about PrEP prior to reading about it was it's like a thing on Grindr. It says it's like you can put like height and things like that, and then it says like there's like a section saying on PrEP, and then you can like say whether you are.
That's
why I looked it up, and then I was like, oh, it's really interesting, because the only reason I would know about that is from the app. You know what I mean? It's just such a random resource.
Yeah. And, so you learned about PrEP from Grindr. I think that's
awesome. Who knew you could learn something from Grindr?
I expect people can learn a lot from Grindr, actually.
Learn how to make better choices.
along those same lines, though, I didn't know what PrEP was, and I thought PrEP was like hormone blockers. So when I read Leo's question, I was like, that's what I was thinking about. I was like, is this, I guess that's another question. Like what about trans people that could potentially go on blockers that don't know about blockers or can't access blockers?
Right.
What can we do about that?
Again, that's really about getting, information out there and getting knowledge out there. I think that, Just before I talk about that, just in terms of you're talking about PrEP and hormones, and I think it's worthwhile mentioning, because since we're on that, one of the things that really worried a lot of people about PrEP was whether it was going to affect their hormones, because drugs can sometimes interact with each other.
Yeah.
And actually, there's lots of studies out there that have looked at this, and it doesn't. So there was one thing that was done like quite a few years ago. It was like a big research study looking at how effective PrEP was. This is in trans women, and they found that a lot of times the women who were given PrEP decided not to take it because they were really worried that it was going to affect their hormones. So in fact, they ended up getting HIV just because they didn't take their PrEP, because they were worried. They kind of prioritized their hormones over PrEP. So one of the things that we're really trying to get the message out there is that it's not going to affect it. It won't push down your you know, your estrogen level or your testosterone level, you know, if you're taking taking those. So yeah, anyway,
write that down, listeners. PrEP does not affect your hormones, okay?
But in terms of in terms of other information about, you know, particularly about hormone therapy, if you think about the model that we used to try to get information out there about PrEP, it didn't come from doctors like myself, you know, going out there and like doing like advertising or like doing even podcasts or anything like this. It was actually from other people within the community. It was like the organizations, the peer support groups, the trans community talking about it within, you know,
spreading the word.
And it kind of it moves more organically. It's like you know, you were saying, you know, you hear about it from all sorts of different sources, you know, Grindr, for example. I think that's probably the best way to do it. You kind of seed that information, and then it moves through a community.
I wish I knew about blockers. I only heard of blockers, I think, probably about 5 years ago. But when I think about people now and imagine myself at that age, if I could have had blockers, I could have spared myself so much.
I think particularly, I work in an adult clinic. I don't work with adolescent service, and I know that at the moment there's like, you know, the wait times to get to be seen there are really, really, really,
oh no, you've really already hit puberty by then.
Yeah, and I find it really distressing, you know, when I see people who are, and they themselves are so upset by this, that you can see the sort of puberty kind of marching on. You know, people are sort of, you know, stuck waiting for treatment. I often think, you know, if I, you know, I started hormones when I was like 21, 20, something like that. It was relatively young, but you know, puberty had already happened for me.
Yeah.
You know, if I'd known about treatment I could have when I was younger, or if I knew that, you know, I could have accessed treatment if it existed back then, you know, my life would, you know, probably would have been quite significantly different.
It's a shame.
So we got to spread the word is what we're saying.
I was gonna ask as well, you know, with the hormone blockers, I think I saw a documentary a while ago, and it was about trans kids, and I'm pretty sure on the documentary they were saying they were considering taking the hormone blockers, but does it affect your height, the blockers? So if you're a trans man, would it affect...
Oh, God, maybe I did have them then.
it can affect a lot of things. So it's not something to be taken, you know, it's something to really consider. And actually, you know, that's why they're prescribed after having, like, you know, a full assessment and actually seeing an endocrinologist. And it can affect things like bone density, it can affect growth. There's a lot of things that they can affect. But, you know, we know that they're safe long term. So, yes, it can affect these things. But we know that many people have had them and then gone on to hormone therapy later on, or even have decided not to go on hormone therapy. So some people decide not to, but have not had long term, bad outcomes from this.
I see.
So, yeah, without going into sort of like,
Are there any opposites of blockers that can make me taller than 5'5"?
Heels.
No.
Yeah, stilettos, that's the answer.
Sorry.
Damn it. Okay, number seven then, Leo, an odd one.
Number seven, are trans people at risk to different sexual health issues than cisgender people? And if so, what are those?
Okay. Good question. So in terms of things like sexually transmitted infections, no, we can get the same infections everybody else gets. So, you know, chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, HIV,
great,
all that stuff. We get all of those. We are not immune to any of those. Sadly, it would be great if we were.
We've got just as much right to chlamydia as anybody else does.
Exactly. Yeah, we should still get it.
There's the trailer right there, guys.
Yeah. So get yourself tested.
You know, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. but it's surprising actually. Some people, you know, it's obviously can be quite a dysphoric experience going in to talk to somebody about it. But you know, yeah. We've tried to do it so much to try to make sexual health testing lots easier. Nowadays, you can actually just get a kit which you could test yourself at home if you don't have any symptoms. If you just want to, you know, chlamydia test or gonorrhea test, you can easily do that. Even a blood test to check for HIV and syphilis, you can kind of do that in the privacy of your own home. If you're coming into a clinic, a lot of times you don't even need to have an examination. You know, and I think that's something that kind of really puts people off. They kind of think, oh God, I'm going to have to show my bits to somebody.
Yeah.
And that's kind of upsetting. There are some things that trans people will get. So if you talk about people who are transmasculine or people who are on testosterone, so if you haven't had lower surgery, you can get this thing called atrophy. So from the front, you can actually get sort of thinning, and it can make any kind of penetrative sex more uncomfortable. You can get, you know, sort of weird kind of discharge, and you can get some bleeding as well, and that can become really quite uncomfortable. And I actually see quite a lot of people come to me in clinic T with that, and they think that, oh my God, I've got some horrible infection, but actually it's just a kind of effect of the testosterone, it's a side effect of that. So that's one thing, and it also makes people more vulnerable to getting other sexually transmitted infections, so particularly things like HIV, hepatitis, and like that, just because that lining there is so much thinner. So if people are, you know, people in that situation, we do try to, and there's treatment for it. So we do try to, you know, assess people, tell people about it, try to get the word out there. Obviously, if you had any genital surgery, then, you know, the infections that you might have might present in slightly different ways. So you might not get the same sort of symptoms that cis people would have, but you still can get that. So again, if things, you know, that feel a little bit, you know, this is all this is out of the ordinary, or you're worried you've had a new sexual partner and you think, you know what, I should probably get myself checked out, you know, I just recommend go and do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, always get checked.
Come down to the sexual health clinic. We try our best to, you know, I wrote some, well, me, but, you know, myself and a lot of other people, we'd written some guidelines a few years back about how to do screening and how to basically to look after and to be sort of trans aware within sexual health and reproductive health services. So there's like national guidelines for all of the clinics within the UK.
And that's those guidelines are for how to, you know, treat trans, because it's not just about the procedures or whatever. It's like that. And that's why we work with the Agora, actually. We've been working with them they've been changing their processes to, you know, how can we change the pronouns more and inclusive. Forms and be more inclusive and you know, adapt. But I guess the overarching point there is just reach out, because then you can have a consultation rather than an examination every time.
100%. Totally.
There's different ways to get stuff sorted. Cool. Question 8. You said, or we've read that when you began your transition in the mid-90s, there weren't any role models that you could relate to. What do we need to do to further speed up the acceptance of trans people, and who are your role models now? Brackets, except us, obviously. She's our role model, mate. Not the other way around.
Thank you. That's an interesting one. Actually, I was thinking about this recently. I'm thinking, well, who were my role models back then? And there was very little out there. But I did actually. I had there were two people actually that did jump out at me when I was kind of thinking about this recently.
They jumped out at me.
From a 2 meter distance.
Here we are, your role models.
Exactly, social distance jumping. it was just you know how it is when you know, you're looking back on all this stuff. So I went to my first bit of university was in Oxford, and then I transferred from there to London halfway through. But when I was there, that's when I transitioned. So I transitioned up over there, and the reason I left was to was basically just to have a fresh start. So I just,
right,
but yeah, and there were some of the students there who weren't particularly nice to me, and did say some pretty horrible things.
Right, we're back in Cambridge in the boat race now. Just for that.
Yeah. I don't do that. That's
like, you sound like a bunch of punts.
Anyway, that's beside the point. But there were two trans women who were there. Basically the first trans woman that I met, like in real life, was somebody called Roz Cavney, and I don't know if you know about her, but she's a poet and a writer, and she's quite prolific on Twitter. Yeah,
I'm gonna look her up.
She tweets quite prolifically, and she's pretty outspoken about stuff she talks about. But she had come to the university to do, I think it was like a speaker thing. It was like the LGB society. It was like, even we didn't have T back then. It was LGB, but the whole thing about like,
no way,
should the T be part of LGBT? Yeah,
I don't even remember that.
Yeah, that was like, yeah, this shows how old I am, isn't it? No. That was a massive debate back then about whether the T should be part of the LGB. But I remember meeting her and thinking, you know, God, you know, this is someone who is like, she is. Yeah, she just was really quite inspiring as a person. And there was another person there who maybe the second person I met who was actually worked for the university, and she transitioned. She'd been in like a super high profile job, and this had gone out and it was in the newspapers. And I think she had a really hard time of that. But you know, even so, you know, there were two women who were. Getting on with their life, doing things. And I thought, you know, if they can do it and actually face some really horrible stuff from the press and from, you know, being out in the public, then surely I can do that too. So it may be, when I wrote that, maybe I wasn't really thinking too hard about the people who were the role models for me. There was certainly nobody that I knew within medicine, for example, was a role model. And I, you know, it's really encouraging now that I look around and there's more trans non-binary medical students that are getting there. It's more doctors that I know. Who are trans and non-binary as well, which is amazing. So literally no one else.
Yeah, I guess it's not just that you're helping people, but just and this is, I guess, is for all trans people, just living your best life and just, you know, staying here in the fight and transitioning and just being yourself is inspiring and will help other trans people. Oh, I feel all warm and fuzzy inside. Okay. Question 9 then, Leo.
Question 9. What is the Gender Recognition Act and what does it need to be? Wait, hold on, sorry. Do you know what I said when I could write?
Sorry, Leo just
can write, but I can't read. What is the Gender Recognition Act and why does it need to be reformed?
Okay. So the Gender Recognition Act was passed in 2004, if I remember rightly.
Good knowledge, good trivia knowledge there. Well done.
So it basically gave legal recognition to trans people to live in the gender they call it acquired gender. It's binary. So you could either be male or female. There's no in between with the gender.
Oh, no. Yeah, of course there's not. No.
But that was how it was written. That's how it was written at the time. Before acquired. That, so like when I was transitioning, you had no legal recognition. So what was on your birth certificate was your legal gender, and that there's no way you could change that. So irrespective of what you did. Legally, like when I transitioned, I was male and I was always going to be male and it was never going to change. We didn't, you know, for example, if I wanted to get married, I couldn't get married as a woman. If I ended up sort of, you know, going to court or anything like that, where my legal gender had to be expressed, you know, I was going to be expressed as male. So it was a major thing to actually have that legal recognition, and it was hard fought. You know, I think, you know, the government really tried to not actually pass this. And actually there were cases that were brought to the European Court of Human Rights, and I think it was one of those things that, you know, I'm incredibly grateful for us being part of Europe at that time, obviously not anymore. because it put the pressure on the government of the day to reform that and to actually start to make that happen. So why does it need changing and updating? Well, all laws need to be updated to move with the times. So it's nothing new about that. So one of the big issues about it is that it's really bureaucratic to get a change. It's expensive, which the government actually have resolved to change. They're going to drop the cost of it. But you also need to have essentially a medical diagnosis of gender dysphoria to be able to do that, to take that forward. So you need to have a report that's done from a professional working within gender identity and one from your GP that basically says that you are trans enough to be able to get one of these
trans enough.
To put it bluntly. One of the things that we lots of people have been talking about is that, you know, do we really need this? Because this is a major hurdle for a lot of people, and actually a lot of trans people don't get don't have a gender recognition certificate, partly because actually you can get through life without ever needing one. It's only for certain things where your legal gender is actually really important, and that's things like getting married, adopting. I can't remember them all, but there's very few. It's kind of like a small number of things. So a lot of people just don't bother.
I think, isn't it 120 quid or something? I think I don't have one. Leo, you don't have one, do you?
No, but I guess if you've got a passport that says male on it, then surely that's fine.
You don't need a gender recognition certificate to change your passport, to change your driving license, to change your bank details, to change your so many things. The stuff that you use on an everyday basis, you don't need that. So it makes no difference to most people, and it makes no difference legally in everyday occurrence. But technically, if you don't have one, your legal gender is that.
I've been told by the GIC to get one anyway because I'm getting married in France, so it's not legal stuff. So Leo, well, let's get each other gender recognition certificates for Christmas.
And actually, because the government have actually said that they're going to change it, so it's not going to cost that much money to get this done. So it's going to be a lot cheaper. So I don't know when that's coming in, but that's the change.
I think I might wait till that.
Listen, Kate, when you're a big time trans podcast influencer, money's no option.
I'm doing the wrong job. I should have done this.
Definitely not. We definitely need all the help we can get.
So I mean, so to go back to that, there are a lot of other countries in the world where you don't have to have that barrier to be able to get legal recognition. So even if you go across across over to Ireland, you don't need to have that medical diagnosis to get legal recognition of your gender. And it hasn't caused problems. I think the big thing that happened as a result of the consultation on Gender Recognition Act was the backlash that came from mainly from the gender critical crowd that kind of started to conflate this with issues around about trans women accessing women's toilets and women's spaces and that sort of stuff, which has nothing to do with the Gender Recognition Act, but it just became a convenient platform on which they could start to just
oh god, don't start us up on that.
I know you've talked about that before, but that sort of stuff, it just gets me riled up. To get back to your question, as a legal act, it was groundbreaking at the time, but it has a lot of limitations. This sort of need for a medical diagnosis, the fact that it's entirely binary, so you can only change from male to female or female to male. That's it. It doesn't acknowledge or even recognize non-binary identities at all. it's really bureaucratic. But
didn't they do a massive survey like a year ago or something?
And that's what I was talking about. Yeah,
but then they did that. But they haven't done anything with it.
Well, they kind of they did a few things with it, but it was basically fairly tokenistic. Not going to change things very
conservative much. Government.
They're going to cut the cost. That's one thing. So.
We'll see.
We won't hold our breath.
Yeah.
Right. We need to do the next question before I start kicking off about Tories and J.K. Rowling and things like that.
Don't get me started on that.
Okay. finally, then question 10. So usually this is a funny question, but I think we decided to try and come up with something better today because we feel this would be a good question to ask. Question 10, if you could say anything to a young trans person who's struggling with coming out, what would you say to them?
Oh, that's a hard one.
No,
but it's a good one. It's a good one.
And an important one.
What would I say? What you're going to do is going to be the best thing that you have ever done. It's going to be hard, but you will not regret it, because you are going to be really authentically, properly you. If I can do anything to make a difference, to help you with that, I will do it. Because the hardest thing, I think, is taking that first step. Once you've done that, then it's not to say it becomes any easier, but you've made that. You know, you've broken ground. You've actually started that process, started that journey. So, yeah,
that's my favorite thing that anyone has ever said on our podcast ever.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to choke. I'm like, oh God. That was a perfect answer. Maybe you should be a motivational, when you're done with medicine,
Oh no, I don't think I could do that.
Thank you so much for coming on. We've been really you've been one of the people we've wanted to get on since we first started it. And we were so chuffed when you said you'd come on, and you certainly haven't disappointed. It's been great.
I was thrilled when you asked me to. I get to go on your podcast. This is amazing. I was just a bit starstruck. So it's really cool.
We are world famous now. Kate.
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
I hope you have to come on again in the future.
I'm really happy to. Yeah,
that would be awesome. And yeah, hopefully our paths will cross again sometime. Cool. See you later.
See ya.
Bye. Bye.
Over and out.